This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, July 31st, 2002. I'm Deepa Fernandez. Senate hearings underway into a U.S. war against Iraq. We go to Capitol Hill and the no-fly zone over Iraq. Another massacre in war-torn Sudan. And as major corporations file to dismiss lawsuits against reparations, activists rally in Harlem. And California will no longer invest its $45 billion investment pool in expatriate corporations. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. A bomb exploded at Hebrew University in Jerusalem today, killing at least six people and wounding 70. Jesse Jackson is also in the occupied territories trying to help move the peace process along. Awadu Davis reports from Ramallah.
Hamas announced in a communique distributed to the press that this attack is a part of its response to the assassination of its leader, Salah Shahadi, an assassination that costed the lives of 17 Palestinian civilians, 11 of them are children, in an Israeli raid in the Gaza Strip. The communique of the Palestinian Authority rejected the responsibility, saying that Israeli occupation and measures lead to this extremist and terrorist act. These tragic events come in a time in which Palestinians are preparing themselves to meet American officials on the peace process, and a minor but important relief that came as a result of the efforts of the American activist Jesse Jackson, who met for the second time with Yasser Arafat in Ramallah. Jesse Jackson is planning also to meet with the spiritual leader of Hamas, Sheikh Ahmed Yassin, but some sources said Jackson might cancel this meeting after today's Jerusalem explosion, yet this was not confirmed officially. Far away from the dream to return to calm, Israelis are trying to bury their victims, and Palestinians try to do the same just before the daily curfew imposed by Israeli forces. This is Awad Davis reporting for Free Speech Radio News from Ramallah.
Turkey's politically weakened prime minister has warned early elections could bring a religious party to power, but the country's parliament approved them anyway. Nicholas Birch reports from Istanbul.
Halfway through what could turn out to be one of the most crucial weeks in Turkey's recent political history, the Turkish parliament voted this evening to hold early elections on November the 3rd. Far more significantly, it now seems probable that a controversial reform package containing bills calling for the abolition of the death penalty and Kurdish education for the country's large Kurdish minority will be approved by deputies tomorrow. The changes are essential to Turkey's hopes of joining the European Union in the near future. Few believed the package would pass the committees preparing it for Parliament. This evening, it did, by a large margin. If the deputies vote tomorrow, as their colleagues did today, the package will become law, no question, one commentator said. And that would be a giant step forward for Turkey. Nicholas Birch for Free Speech Radio News, Istanbul.
Argentina's financial crisis has rippled into neighboring Uruguay, where banks remain closed for a second consecutive day. Half of Uruguay's exports go to Argentina and Brazil, and Argentina's economic crisis has hit Uruguay's banking system hard. In past weeks, a panicked population has been withdrawing their money, further hurting Uruguay's banks that have been dealing with a 40% drop in deposits this year. Yesterday, crowds rushed to ATM machines when they heard that the bank closure was imminent. As Uruguayan officials ask the IMF for another loan installment, U.S. Treasury Department officials voiced support for the action. One anonymous central bank official said they asked the government to keep the banks closed until Friday. 45 whales beached themselves and eventually died yesterday. Emily Bernhardt has more.
Last Monday, 56 pilot whales stranded on Cape Cod. Initially, it seemed as though 46 of the whales might be saved. Despite rescue attempts, the whales stranded again, and by Tuesday night, all members of the pod had either died or were euthanized due to their deteriorating health. Whale strandings have always occurred and are considered to be a natural phenomenon. Cape Cod is especially notorious for whale strandings, and one possible explanation is that the geographic contours of the ocean floor around the Cape may act as a trap. Another theory suggests that, because pilot whales are very social and herd together, they will follow their leaders or care for sick members, even at the risk of their own well-being. any possible direct human causes for this stranding won't come to light for some time. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Emily Bernhardt.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
In the Senate Foreign Relations Committee today, senators heard that it would be more effective and less costly if the US were to attack Iraq sooner rather than later. But questions remain about the credentials of some of today's witnesses. Critics of US policy toward Iraq and some senators complain the committee's witness list is stacked with those who favor renewed attacks. Joshua Chaffin has this report from Capitol Hill.
In hearings that may determine how free a hand Congress will give the White House in its return to direct warfare against Saddam Hussein, at times it seemed that members consider the attack a foregone conclusion. Committee Chair and Delaware Democrat Joseph Biden.
We must confront clear dangers with a new sense of urgency and resolve. Saddam Hussein's pursuit of weapons of mass destruction, in my view, is one of those clear dangers.
The three witnesses on the morning panel were unanimous in their assessment that the United States would be better off attacking Iraq sooner than later because they said Saddam Hussein has, or could soon have, nuclear weapons to use against the U.S. or its allies. Here's former Chief Weapons Inspector for the U.N., Ambassador Richard Butler.
If you defer, put off to another day, the solution to a serious problem, it will only be harder and costlier in the end.
But the risks to U.S. forces and Iraqi civilians could be considerable, according to security expert Anthony Cordesman, who did the play-by-play on the last war with Iraq for various television networks. He spoke in detail about the forces Iraq could muster if provoked. Cordesman emphasized that before attacking Iraq, the U.S. would need the cooperation of Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Kuwait, Oman, and others in the Middle East, which he seemed to doubt was immediately possible.
We will not have a clear smoking gun. There will not be a simple cause. Most of our NATO allies will at best be reluctant and seek, if anything, to delay it, to use the UN.
Eric Gustafson with the Education for Peace in Iraq Center says the witness list in the Senate's hearings on Iraq is flawed, that the witnesses should have included former UN weapons inspectors who are critical of the UN and the U.S. handling of the situation there.
Richard Butler was part of the problem with UNSCOM. He was the director in the final 2 years when it was learned that UNSCOM was being used by U.S. intelligence to carry out espionage against the Iraqi government. UNSCOM's mandate was undermined. The U.S. had its own political interests, learning about where Saddam might be. And then in the bombing in 1998, it was learned that that intelligence that had been gathered under UNSCOM was used in choosing targets when the United States bombed Iraq.
Critics of U.S. and U.N. Iraq policy are also concerned about the inclusion of Kadir Hamza on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee's witness list on Iraq. Hamza's a former nuclear scientist for Saddam Hussein who defected in 1994. One critic of Hamza's today said he'd say anything to start a war with Iraq. Here's Kadir Hamza on the committee room floor. How many countries would you put on the list of countries that see Iraq as a direct and immediate threat?
I would say the U.S. right now and Britain stand more or less on their own in assessing the Iraqi threat, together with some other countries, probably, I don't know.
Rhode Island Republican Senator Lincoln Chafee was also concerned about the witness list, and he questioned whether the threat from Iraq is really as imminent as the panelists insist.
We just don't know, and I think that's really the key. It would be great to hear from some of those officers or anybody else that has a different point of view on this. What is the threat? I think the three of you have been very strong. The threat is immediate and it's real. And I think for the benefit of our study, it would have been good to hear an opposing point of view.
Pentagon leaks in recent weeks suggest an attack on Iraq could involve sending 250,000 Americans into battle. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee resumes its meeting on Iraq tomorrow. Josh Chaffin, Free Speech Radio News, Capitol Hill.
Although the Bush administration has not yet declared war against Iraq, American warplanes regularly bomb the country in the north and south under the guise of the so-called no-fly zones. But Baghdad has been defying these zones by reopening Iraqi Airways civilian flights to the south of the country. Free Speech Radio News correspondent Jeremy Scahill was recently in Iraq, where he was one of the few Americans to fly through the no-fly zone in a plane that did not belong to the Pentagon.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. On behalf of the Iraq Airways Company,
Iraqi Airways has returned to the not-so-friendly skies. For more than a decade, Iraq's planes have been prevented from flying, the results of threats by the U.S. and Britain to shoot down any Iraqi aircraft that flies to the north or south of the country. American and British warplanes patrol Iraq's airspace under the guise of so-called no-fly zones, regularly bombing areas of northern and southern Iraq. But for more than a year, Baghdad has been openly defying the threats. This flight, the morning shuttle from Baghdad to the southern city of Basra, has just crossed the 32nd parallel into the no-fly zone. The chief steward on the plane informs us that American pilots have warned the Iraqi plane from continuing on or risk being shot down. But the plane's steward, a Kurdish man named Riyad, says that the Iraqi pilot told the Americans to shut up.
Iraq Airways, we have to fly it. We have to enter the fly zone. We don't care about what's going on.
But away from the upbeat defiance of the Iraqi crew once again flying across their country, on the ground in Basra lies the harsh reality. The Iraqi government says that more than 1,300 people have been killed in these no-fly zones. Just moments after the Iraqi Airways plane lands in Basra, air raid sirens sound in the distance. American warplanes have just bombed near a village a stone's throw away. The Iraqi government says 4 civilians were wounded. Senior officials in the Bush administration talk of an uprising from the Shiites in southern Iraq. But everywhere you go in the south, people say it's the sanctions and American missiles that terrorize them. In Basra, one need not walk far to find a victim of the no-fly zones. In the poor Al Jumeirah neighborhood lies a street now known as Missile Street, named after a deadly U.S. bombing on January 25, 1999, which killed 4 small children. Among the dead, a 6-year-old boy named Haider. His mother, a primary school teacher, still carries his name. In Iraqi culture, a woman takes the name of her firstborn son and is forever known as the mother of that child. Umm Haider says she is permanently haunted by that day in January when a U.S. missile took the life of her firstborn.
Till now, I didn't forget what's happened in that day. In 1930, in the morning, we were sitting in the... I was teaching my children, and big voice and become nearly. Then a big bomb happened. The glasses of the windows and the dishes and cups, glasses in the kitchen, all of them fall down and broken. Then my face is, and 2 children with me, Hindu and Al-Hamza, they were with me. But Mustafa and Haider, they were out in the street. Then our faces is full of blood because the glasses of the windows and the dishes. Then I left them and remember my 2 children, they were out in the street. I take my cover and run quickly to the street. I saw the street is full of smoke and dust, and it was like midnight. Then I run quickly and call my children. Haider, Mustafa, Haider, Mustafa. I didn't find them. At last, I saw a small hill of broken wood and iron and pieces of and dust. And then I said, my old son, Mustafa, Haider, full of blood. His face is, the blood is cover his face and his body, his head, and a circle of blood under his head on the ground. I didn't forget that, never.
Haider's other son, Mustafa, survived the attack. He lost 2 fingers and now lives with shrapnel in his liver. The Bush administration says the no-fly zones in the north and south are enforced to protect the Kurds in northern Iraq and the Shiites in southern Iraq from Saddam Hussein's forces. Washington refers to its operations in these regions as United Nations mandated.
That's a total misnomer. There is no UN mandate for the establishment of these two no-fly zones.
Hans von Spanek knows a lot about UN mandates. He's a former Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations. In 2000, he resigned his post as head of the UN humanitarian program in Iraq in protest of the U.S.-led sanctions.
It is an illegal establishment of a zone for bilateral interests by the U.S. and by the U.K. If you want to be very cynical, then you say what has in fact resulted is death and destruction, because on average, once every 3 days during the time I was in Iraq, there were bombing incidents, and the casualties were in the very areas that you allegedly had established to protect people. So how can, out of 10,000 meter height, how can you protect a Shia minority? That is a fantasy. But the cruel reality is that people are dying as a result of these no-fly zones.
As the Bush administration moves ahead with its official war plans in Iraq, the people of Basra live under a war that for them never ends. The only question they ask now is how much worse it will get and when. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jeremy Scahill.
Following last week's peace accords between the Sudanese rebel leader and the government, which to many signal considerable progress towards peace in a country racked by war since the mid-80s, yesterday it appears that government forces and militia committed a massacre killing up to 1,000 people. As so often has happened in the past, these latest allegations of a massacre have cast doubt upon the real commitment to peace on the part of the various warring parties in southern Sudan. For almost two decades, the southern Sudanese have been battling for independence against the government in the north of the country. And in their traditionally polygamous societies, women have always played a crucial role in a family's accumulation of wealth through the exchange of cattle at marriage. However, the country's near 20-year civil war has added to the pressure faced by women in the region. Rupert Cook reports.
A traditional wedding song at a feast day in the village of Lankien, a newer community of some 42,000 people in the eastern Upper Nile region of southern Sudan. On the marriage day, the unmarried men and women engage in an elaborate form of singing and dancing courtship. Yet, in this area of southern Sudan, one immediately notices a discrepancy. The women outnumber the men by 2-1, and many of the men are elderly. There is a simple reason for this. The war has left a lot of widows and unmarried girls in Lankien. Sarah Chol is a member of the local women's group.
There are two main problems for widows here in newer society. The first is having to take care of the children. If your husband dies, and maybe you have 2 or 3 children, it's very difficult to take care of them, because the man is the decision maker, and he's also the one who takes care of the children, finding where the food is going to come from. He's also the one who does the cultivation, who looks after the cattle, and he's the one who organizes the home. And the problem is that your children will suffer a lot. And with some widows, the children will go and look around because they don't have enough to survive, and then they go and steal things, and the widows feel very bad. The other thing is that if the widow doesn't have a child, or has 2 children and wants another child, it's difficult to find someone, because, as you know, every man has a wife, and so you have to go around, and then the wife who has a husband, if the widow is looking for her husband, it's also a big problem for her, because she doesn't want that to happen, and then you feel very bad. You don't have enough support. You don't have a happy or peaceful life.
The war in southern Sudan has dragged on for 20 years. 2 million people have been killed. Besides the loss of their husbands, women have to face the added threat of sexual violence. Molok Ring Kerr is a senior rebel SPLA commander in the Dinka region of Sobat County.
He says, in our culture here as Dinka, it's bad for a man or another man to rape your wife or your mother or your sister, you kill him immediately. This is before Sudan war. Now, when it appeared that Sudanese troops used to rape our wives or our sisters, then we said this type of a person, when doing such a things, we cannot stay together.
The two main southern Sudanese tribes, the Nuer and the Dinka, are both semi-nomadic peoples. The principal currency of wealth is the cow. Women, and particularly young girls, play a central role in the accumulation of wealth. In this polygamous society, when a man marries, he and his family pay a dowry made up of cattle to the bride's family. And that means an easy equation between more daughters, so more brides-to-be, and increased wealth. In the reproductive economy of southern Sudan, boys are also valued. They can continue the struggle for independence, and will also provide the extended family, or clan, with security for the wealth accumulated through the exchange of cattle and brides. However, with little or no health facilities, maternal and child mortality are major problems for women in southern Sudan. Rebecca Niawade is a traditional birth attendant in Lankien.
There are a lot of problems in my work, especially with the children, because ladies are dying during birth and the child is left behind, orphaned, as a very, very small child. And most of those children die because there's no support for those small children. They need a bottle with a teat to suck from, but there are no bottles. If only we had some of those bottles and the facilities to support the children who have lost their mothers during delivery. That's a major problem.
The traditional cattle economy puts enormous pressure on women who cannot bear children, besides making education a distant dream for most girls, who will be expected to marry young. Yet, some women are beginning to question the status quo. Elizabeth Niagun is the leader of the local women's group.
The problem is that most of the men have been killed. If one man has five women, and then he is killed, and then they have to find another man, and if the other man has four wives, and then he dies as well, then you see it's more and more women and fewer men. This is making the situation much worse. Later on, if the fighting ends, if there's independence, the problem will be solved, and the men will marry only one lady, because it's good to have one wife, one man.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Rupert Cook in Lankien, southern Sudan.
Major corporations, including Fleet and Aetna, today went to court to try to dismiss lawsuits filed against them by African Americans for reparations from profits made by these corporations during the slave trade. The hearing in a Brooklyn federal district court today was adjourned to September 12 to give both sides more time to amend and consolidate their cases. Meanwhile, as Nigel Middleton reports, activists rallied last night in Harlem to show their support for reparations nationwide.
We're here because we're victims of a crime that has never, ever, ever been prosecuted and for which we have never yet been compensated.
Attorney Roger Wareham is one of the lawyers suing American corporations that he says profited from slavery.
We were tortured. We were raped. We were forcibly impregnated. We were enslaved.
The lawsuit seeks damages from Aetna, Fleet Boston, and CSX for the barbarity inflicted upon 8 million African slaves and their descendants. The class action lawsuit, the first suit of its kind, demands a fair accounting of the profits these corporations made from slavery so they can be made to pay reparations to the descendants of slaves. Yesterday in Harlem, where over 150 gathered to discuss reparations, the United States government was also a target of sharp criticism. Wareham, who attended last summer's World Conference Against Racism in Durban, South Africa, denounced the American delegation's walkout. But reparations activists were also encouraged because the conference declared slavery and the slave trade crimes against humanity. The conference ended on September 11th, and activists had planned to return and stage a national day of protest. Then came the events of September 11th. The December 12th movement, the organizers of yesterday's gathering, has joined the United Black National Front in calling for a national march on Washington, D.C. Activists want the country to acknowledge the wealth of this country was built upon slavery, and the government and corporations who profited from slavery owe African Americans. Khalil al-Mustafa of the Youth for Reparations campaign was at yesterday's rally and will attend the Millions for Reparations rally in the Capitol.
Cotton, is it that they think that we've forgotten living up in this country that's rotten? Yo, I stay fighting for my mule, for my plot.
Expectations for reparations for centuries of unpaid labor and inhumane treatment date back to the end of the Civil War. The government initially promised 40 acres of redistributed land and a mule. Many bills seeking redress have since been introduced to Congress, but to no avail. The latest was introduced by Representative John Conyers after Japanese Americans obtained reparations from the government for their internment and those of their parents during World War II. After 13 years, Conyers' bill that merely asked for a commission to study the impact of slavery has yet to be passed.
Cotton, is it that they think that we've forgotten living up in this country that's rotten? Yo, why stay? Fighting for my mule, for my plot. They want to start, let them start off with the cotton. I'm talking about cotton shirts and cotton socks, cotton pants and cotton cots, say cotton bandanas, cotton swabs, your cotton Q-tips, cotton hats, your cotton lace, your shoes with everything, y'all. Cotton drawers to cotton panties, all the cotton in this world, even cotton candy. Half off foam cotton, polyester blends. My people, yo, we should never have to pay for cotton again.
Activists argue that, like Japanese Americans, Jews, and Native Americans, today's African Americans are entitled to reparations because they are still suffering from the effects of slavery, such as pervasive racial discrimination, poverty, and a feeling of lack of self-worth. This view has been shared by many city councils across the country. The Millions for Reparations March is scheduled for August 17th, and organizers hope it will serve as a wake-up call for the nation. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nadja Middleton in Harlem. Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations KPFA in Berkeley and WBAI in New York and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. The newscast is produced by Aaron Glantz, headlines editor Randy Zimmerman, technical producer Jade Paget-Seekins. We have technical assistance from Kata Mester and Nell Geiser, web support from Vanessa Tate. Our interns are Rosalind Fay, Susan Chelli, Rich Kim, Fernando Romero, Christopher Martinez, and William Perdomo. I'm Deepa Fernandez.
I'm Martha Baskin in Seattle. I report for Free Speech Radio News because it dares to tell the stories ignored by the mainstream media. Free Speech Radio News only stays on the air with your financial support. Please make a tax-deductible donation to Free Speech Radio News online at www.fsrn.org. That's www.fsrn.org. Or call 510-287-5551. That's 510-287-5551. Thank you for your support.